resistance against Israel and its U.S. backers. Does this moment empower Iran?
Attack of Israel on Gaza has garnered a lot of anger and sympathy for Palestinians in the region in general. Definitely Iran and its proxies want to benefit from that shift in public opinion. But it's also the case that Iran is trying to recoup some PR points, given that in effect, they have not stepped in a major way to stand with Hamas, like they did what Hamas wanted them to do and what many Palestinians want them to do. This is a fallback PR action.
Now, you say that Iran and the U.S. really don't want this to become a larger regional war, but how great is the danger that this spirals into that anyways?
Well, I think both sides have long experience with this type of, let's call it limited escalation. This is not new to the post-October 7 period. It's been going on effectively for years. Of course, the risk is always there, particularly if, you know, any U.S. Location is attacked with larger losses than we saw. But I do think President Biden and this administration are not unpredictable, let's call it that way. Mm-hmm. And hence, I don't think either side will, you know, by mistake stumble into a major escalation. They have long experience in this.
Now, the UN has been warning that Iran is rapidly building up stockpiles of enriched uranium. Are Israeli and U.S. actions giving Iran additional incentives to speed up its nuclear development programs? How much of this is about the Israel-Hamas war?
Effective set of proxy forces. The attacks of Hamas on October 7, I think, prove for the Iranians their model of asymmetric warfare. In effect, Israel could not effectively defend against that Hamas attack. Iran, it's noteworthy that Iran did not, let's call it, deploy Hezbollah on the northern front in a major way. So I think Iran feels that strategically, Israel is extremely vulnerable while they are not under attack or vulnerable. So I think they feel fairly satisfied. They already have a lot of incentives to consider about their nuclear program. I don't think this changes the calculus dramatically.
Paul Salem is the president and CEO of the Middle East Institute. Thank you so much for your time and your insights.
Thank you for having me.
Associates of the Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny lost track of him for nearly 3 weeks before he resurfaced on Christmas Day. Navalny had been imprisoned just a few hours outside of Moscow, but he was moved to a penal colony above the Arctic Circle. We reached Vladimir Milov, an opposition politician and economic advisor to Navalny. I asked Milov how they managed to find him.
Well, that was a long and tedious process. His legal team actually were sending formal inquiries. I now understand that they did so regarding over 600 of the Russian different detention facilities across the country. So they received some formal replies. And actually, at some point, they were able to locate him in this remote penal colony in the Arctic. So as a matter of fact, there are very few detention centers of that sort. So they were really suspecting that he might be somewhere there, and they located him.
Yeah, and we now have word also on some of his social media accounts, a sort of letter description of what his situation has been like these past few weeks.
Yes, he was Navalny, which was his more way to deal with all this harshness. You know, he spent many long terms in detention all over the past decade, so he's actually quite familiar with all the circumstances. Mm-hmm. The boss, he calls the shots, and that's a pretty clear signal that he would want to enter a new presidential term through intimidation, repression, more pressure on the society. And so this is how Putin is supposed to run his presidential campaign and enter the new term.
Because Putin sees Navalny as a potential threat?
Putin is well aware that the Russian society, in a large part of it, is strongly against him. There is definitely no love between Putin and the Russian society. People are just scared, very much afraid about their own lives and security and so on. This is why they don't speak up. There's this constant fear in the Kremlin that at some point people will say enough is enough and they will begin to speak up.
It seems essentially certain that Putin will win a fifth term during the elections coming up this March. And I look at someone like you, you're living in political exile in Lithuania. Alexei Navalny is in prison circle. You all have sacrificed so much, and yet it seems certain that Putin will win re-election. So help us understand what you all are trying to do with the opposition movement.
We try to first focus on talking to the Russian people and broadcasting, because political activity is effectively prohibited on the ground in my country. But what we can do is we can maintain the spirit of resistance. We can keep the people informed. So we try to maintain connection. We try to talk to people and prepare them for better days, for the situation when they will be able to come and speak up against the government. I compared this with the last totally controlled Soviet elections of the 1984. It was like on surface, total calm, 99.95% for the Communist Party. If you recall Russian history, things can unravel pretty fast. So we try to maintain the degree of this underground resistance.
That's Vladimir Milov. He's the economic advisor to Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny. He joined us via Skype. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure.
'Tis the season to send a text.
Text me Merry Christmas. Let me know you care.
Yep, turns out Christmas is the busiest day of the year for texting. We've had a couple of days now to reflect and maybe regret.
Maybe you texted an old flame. It's pretty common. So common, there's a term for it, Marleying.
The term is inspired by Jacob Marley, Scrooge's former business partner from A Christmas Carol. You know, because he showed up after a long period of time of no contact.
So a survey by the dating site eHarmony in the UK finds close to 1 in 10 singles has been Marleyed, while nearly as many admit they've done some Marleying.
Texting without a response may be the real Christmas ghost. But hey, text messages have been a part of the holiday spirit for a while now.
Back in December of 1992, Neil Papworth sent the world's first text message, and it said, Merry Christmas. This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on WPR. It's 8:19 on this Wednesday. Glad to have you along this morning. Because it's a Wednesday, Wisconsin Life is coming up later this hour. Today, we're going to revisit one of our favorite stories from this past year. It's highlighting a chef in the Madison area who was a finalist for a James Beard Award. That story is coming up in about 25 minutes here on Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Join PBS Wisconsin Education for a winter of wonder at PBS Wisconsin. Count on PBS Wisconsin to be there wherever your winter adventures take you, at school, at home, or on the go on your TV, tablets, and mobile devices. Explore a wonderful world of education now at pbswisconsin.org/education.
This organization can partner in providing the WPR programs that enrich our communities. Join at wpr.org/sponsor.
Support comes from Sylvan Learning of Kenosha, offering personalized tutoring from certified teachers that's designed to inspire, convenient scheduling, and affordable hourly rates. Explore the options, search Sylvan Learning of Kenosha, or call 262-694-6286.
There's fog throughout most of the state today, but things clearing by mid-morning. It'll be dry with high temperatures in the 30s and 40s. Chance for a wintry mix in eastern Wisconsin overnight into tomorrow. Good chance for mixed precipitation throughout the day as well, with highs in the 30s and 40s. That'll likely linger into Friday morning in the southern part of the state. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Cy Sims Foundation. Since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at Cy Sims Foundation Radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Asma Khalid.
I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. Most of us think of public parks as a place to play, relax, or work out. But urban forager Douglas Kent sees food.
This whole area is just covered in just goodness. These are all the thistles. You can see them all blooming here. The root makes a coffee substitute. The flowers are edible. The seeds are edible.
Kent teaches ecological land management at Cal Poly Pomona and is the author of Foraging Southern California. He recently took me on a tour of Ken Malloy Harbor Regional Park near the Port of Los Angeles.
We've been walking 10 minutes and you showed us things for cordage. You've showed us things for teas. You've showed us things for medicine to heal our wounds. Essentially, this is a supermarket that we're walking through, right?
Yeah, actually right here. This is a Brazilian pepper.
Clusters of what look like small pink berries.
I'll taste one, sure.
Oh, yeah. It's really slight. So this was a staple of French cooking for years.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
That was really nice. That's a really nice feeling.
Doug showed us that nearly every plant we saw in this park could be foraged. And these plants grow all over California year-round.
You forage greens late winter, early spring, seeds from late spring to early summer, roots late summer to early fall, and then bark and stuff like that from late fall to early winter.
And if you think this kind of abundance only exists in California with its mild winters, you'd be wrong. From Columbus, Ohio, Alexis Nicole Nelson explains how to find things we may not think of as food and then make them delicious.
I think a lot of people don't realize how biodiverse their neighborhoods are, like heading into the winter months. I could walk my block and probably find at least 10 different edible plants.
Nelson is a James Beard award-winning chef who has amassed millions of followers using the handle Black Forager on Instagram and TikTok.
The volume ratio is one of dust to like 2.5 of water.
Mixy, mixy.
It may not look like much now, but it'll thicken up as we cook.
She credits her parents for her deep knowledge of plants.
Kind of like kids who are raised learning a different language, I was raised recognizing leaf patterns and branching patterns and buds and, you know, the time of year that certain plants are doing certain things. As a person who has like struggled with my own that is the inside of my brain.
Alexis, I notice in some of your videos that you actually thank the plant or the tree before harvesting. Can you talk about why you do that?
I think we've kind of become really disconnected from remembering that the trees, the plants, shrubs, animals are like also living things. Yes, they're perceiving the world around them and interacting with it in different ways than we do, but their lives also matter. It helps you build a better relationship with the world around you, and it helps you really savor the importance of what it is you're gathering.
Why do you think more people have become interested in foraging lately?
In terms of very recent things, I think, you know, that very casual global pandemic that affected every single one of us left a lot of people wanting activity. And foraging is a great use of outdoor time. If you find a food that you end up really liking, pay off every single time that you do it. And we are in times in which you have to get your dopamine where you can get it.
Now, you end every video with the catchphrase, don't die. Tell us why.
Because dying is bad, eh? It's generally frowned upon in most
I think we can
societies.
All agree that that is true.
And, you know, foraging, everyone wants greens and flowers and berries, but you do have to remember that safety is the most important. Originally ended a video that way for the first time as a joke because my partner is an attorney. And he was like, oh, no, you got to remind people to not die.
Is foraging different for a Black forager?
Yeah, I would absolutely say that it is. We have a pretty fraught history of our relationship with outdoor spaces and with the food knowledge of those spaces, you know, during the times when people were enslaved. Foraging was like a really great way to round out a meal. There was a whole lot of information and knowledge transfer between indigenous populations and Black populations, trying to help each other kind of better survive. People still sometimes get uncomfortable when they see a Black person doing an activity that they cannot immediately identify. And if you've seen my videos, I'm usually in like floofy dresses and a lot of makeup or flower crowns, because I would always rather have someone come up to me and ask what they're doing before like calling the police. So I do think that foraging as a Black person is a little different in the United States. I do think that it's important to be getting a lot of different perspectives to remind people that at some point in time, every single one of us is here today because one of our ancestors, however far back you have to go, foraged. And I just...
Social media extrovert Alexis Nicole Nelson. Alexis, thank you.
Thank you so much.
This is NPR News.
Gambling in the U.S. has never been easier, but of the millions of people who have a gambling disorder, few are in treatment.
We're still sitting back and making problem gamblers work hard to find the help that is available. That doesn't work well for any other addiction.
Why advocates are pushing for better access to help and more funding to study problem gambling.
That story plus the day's news from 4 until 6:30 today on WPR.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
Good morning. Glad to have you along with us for Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:29 on this Wednesday with news from NPR and WPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas will be meeting with Mexico's president today. Andrés Manuel López Obrador is expected to be pressed to do more to reduce the flow of migrants to the U.S. southern border. Thousands arrive each day. NPR's Jasmine Garst reports on what the Mexican government is likely to seek in return at the talks in Mexico City.
President López Obrador has said he's willing to work with the U.S. The Mexican president has also made it clear he wants the Biden administration to ease sanctions on the governments of Cuba and Venezuela. A significant percentage of migrants are from Venezuela, and he wants more aid to Latin America.
Republicans in Congress want changes to border and immigration policies before signing off on President Biden's request for additional U.S. aid to Ukraine and Israel. As the Israeli military expands its ground offensive to urban refugee camps in areas of Gaza, aid workers say humanitarian
Gaza every day bringing supplies. Since the war, it's been fewer than 100 on average per day.
This is NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Alex Crow. A new study by a researcher at the University of Wisconsin-Madison found that a lack of nurturing as a child is associated with accelerated aging later in life. The research looks at changes to a person's genome that have been linked to their environment or behaviors. These markers risk of age-related diseases or death. Professor Lauren Schmitz found that people who lacked parental involvement or affection as a child had markers of advanced aging. She says that could be due to mental health impact of this deprivation.
What we also saw in our data was that these individuals tended to smoke more in their life and engage in other unhealthy behaviors that may have contributed to a large part to this accelerated aging.
Schmidt says the findings could help inform public health interventions for people who have adverse childhood experiences. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss says he will likely appeal the Wisconsin Supreme Court decision overturning the state's electoral maps to the U.S. Supreme Court. In a statement yesterday, Voss said that he would, quote, pursue all federal issues arising out of the redistricting litigation at the U.S. Supreme Court. The Wisconsin Supreme Court declared the state's current maps unconstitutional last week because several districts are not contiguous. The court also said it was prepared to redraw the maps if the state legislature and Governor Tony Evers can't come to an agreement ahead of the 2024 elections. Wisconsin Elections Commission officials have said that new maps need to be in place by March 15th. That's according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. A Walmart in Sparta was evacuated on Tuesday after an apparent arson. The fire was started in the fabric section of the Walmart and was too large for the store's sprinkler system. That's according to the Sparta Police Department. A 17-year-old was, quote, quickly identified, arrested, and charged with arson and recklessly endangering safety. The police press release indicates that the store will remain closed for at least the next few days. The fire caused at least $7 million worth of damage. In weather today, highs in the 30s and 40s with clearing skies throughout the day. Chance for a wintry mix overnight in eastern Wisconsin into tomorrow. I'm Alex Crow. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security. More information is available online at carnegie.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Asma Khalid. The United Nations Security Council resolution on Gaza last week did not call for an immediate ceasefire, as many nations around the world had hoped it would. Instead, the compromise measure focuses on the humanitarian crisis, demanding faster aid deliveries into Gaza. The U.S. and Russia abstained from the vote. One country that played a major role in shaping the measure is the United Arab Emirates. The UAE is serving a rotation on the Security Council that ends this week. And I spoke with the country's ambassador to the UN, Lana Nuseiba, who told me how the resolution came together.
It's clear from the very beginning of this conflict that a number of countries called for and felt, including the United Arab Emirates, that the way forward was a humanitarian scene, really a code red for humanity, what is happening on the ground in Gaza. So the UAE is, of course, the Arab representative on the council and fully represents the Arab perspective. We built up the Security Council's understanding of the file by taking them, as the UAE, to the Rafah border. We met victims, including children who'd endured and survived this hell that had been unleashed on Gaza following the 7th of October attacks on Israel, which were also unacceptable. Mm-hmm. We saw thousands of trucks trying and failing to enter through this choke point at the Rafah border. And now you've got nearly 1 million people crammed into an area at the Rafah border where before only a few hundred thousand had lived. So 10% of what is necessary to sustain the population is going in through that choke point, and half the people of Gaza are now starving. And of course, there is a real possibility of regional spillover, and I think we're seeing that.
Ambassador, there was a lot of negotiations to get this resolution through. It was not the first resolution that you all initially put forth. Can you help us understand what some of the provisions were that you ultimately had to remove to get a consensus behind this?
There are countries who wield a veto on the Security Council who have very specific equities on this file. Gaza, closely with the U.S. mission, they did not want to veto a humanitarian-focused resolution, and we worked very hard to keep the focus on saving lives, having impact on the ground. Of course, it did not go as far as the majority of council members would have liked it to go.
To be clear to listeners, Russia, in addition to the United States, were the two countries that abstained from supporting this resolution, but did not veto it.
Well, correct. If you have two P5 members abstaining on a resolution, I think a lot of countries had to make compromises in order for it to be passed. So it was difficult negotiations, but I think the adoption is going to help more people in the immediate term. than political grandstanding that is vetoed and that does nothing to move us closer to trying to save lives.
Ambassador, my colleague Scott Detrow interviewed the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Linda Thomas-Greenfield, on Friday after the resolution went through, and he asked her specifically why the United States abstained, and this is what she said.
It was the lack of condemnation of Hamas that was specifically a concern for the United States.
Did the United States convey that specific concern to you all as well?
There was a earlier resolution in the course of this conflict that was vetoed that did condemn Hamas that many council members voted in favor of and that was put forward by the Brazilians at the time. We're talking about 20,000 dead that we know of, 8,000 children that we know of, let alone those bodies that will be found under the rubble at a future date. Any future resolution would also have to take note and condemn what has been
actually win over more support.
Given the current geopolitical environment in terms of getting a resolution adopted, humanitarian aid to helping their rightful request for self-determination and statehood, including that injustice.
That's the United Arab Emirates Ambassador to the United Nations, Lana Nusseibeh. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Asma, for having me.
Shoppers aren't holding back this holiday season. Retail spending isn't as rip-roaring as it was last year, but it's still up over the holidays. Early data shows that consumers remain confident, if not giddy, in a good sign for the broader economy. NPR's Becky Sullivan reports.
During the pandemic, shoppers flush with cash from stimulus checks spent more than ever, spending big on outdoor equipment and furniture for home offices, all while inflation drove prices higher and higher. So year to year, holiday spending grew by 8 or even 12%. This year, like, says Bert Flickinger.
Consumers spent, and they spent on practical items, gift cards, food, clothing, and shoes, and less on electronics this year.
Flickinger is managing director at the Strategic Resource Group, a business consulting firm. Consumers didn't go wild spending on expensive things like fancy furniture or jewelry or electronics, he says. Instead, people focused their spending on smaller scale stuff like new clothes and eating out. Sales at restaurants this holiday season were up by nearly 8% over last year.
People had really been well supplied and not buying big ticket items, but consumables, whether it's edibles or wearables. Really led. So it's a practical Christmas, Hanukkah, New Year's season.
That shoppers have money to spend during the holidays is evidence that the economy is working right now, said Jack Kleinhans, chief economist at the National Retail Federation.
Consumers are spending at a decent clip, and they've been remarkably resilient this year, and surprisingly so because of the resilience that we've seen in the labor market.
Unemployment has stayed low, and employers keep hiring. Meanwhile, inflation is slowing down. Prices are only up 2.6% over this time last year, which isn't too far from the Fed's target rate of 2%. That said, there are some yellow flags in this economy. There's the record amount of credit card debt, more than $1 trillion, and millions of people have recently had to start making federal student loan payments again after a long pause during the pandemic. Still, Kleinhess says he's optimistic. For retailers, 2023 isn't done just yet. The week after Christmas is one of the busiest weeks of the year.
People have their gift cards. They're making exchanges. They're looking for sales. And of course, there's returns that go along with it.
All signs point to a solid finish for the year, he says. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Really glad you're with us at 8:42 on this Wednesday. And because it's a Wednesday, we've got Wisconsin Life coming up in just a couple of minutes. Today, we're going to be taking a look back at some of our favorite stories from 2023. And this one involves a story about a Madison chef who was a semifinalist for a James Beard Award this year. That story is coming up in about 3 minutes on WPR.
WPR has been a radio pioneer since 1917. That's more than a century of information, connection, and inspiration for the people of Wisconsin. When you give, you ensure that WPR's bright future includes plenty of in-depth news, world-class music, and thought-provoking discussions and entertainment. Thank you for supporting the important role of WPR in your community with your year-end gift right now at wpr.org/donate.
Support for WPR comes from Wisconsin Dells, with indoor water parks and theme parks, dining, entertainment, and more. Information on holiday happenings at wisdells.com. Wisconsin Dells, the water park capital of the world.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the Kenosha ADRC's Family Caregiver Support Group meets in person and virtually. Join fellow caregivers, share your experiences, ask questions, and learn from others. For more, 6650.
At 8:44, here's what's happening in news. Israel is expanding its ground offensive in Gaza into densely populated urban refugee camps in the central part of the territory. That's according to the Associated Press. Secretary of State Antony Blinken will be in Mexico City today to meet with Mexican President Andres Manuel López Obrador. This comes as a migrant caravan, estimated to be between 6 and 10,000 people, makes its way towards the U.S. border. Madison police are investigating a potential hate crime where a restaurant was vandalized with anti-Islamic graffiti. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss says he will likely appeal the Wisconsin Supreme Court decision overturning the state's electoral maps to the U.S. Supreme Court. And shoppers were evacuated from a Farm and Fleet store in Janesville yesterday due to a bomb threat. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and it's time for Wisconsin Life. This week, we are revisiting some of our favorite stories from 2023. Here's producer Maureen McCullum with a story about a Madison chef who was a semifinalist for a James Beard Award this year.
It's 1 hour before the restaurant opens, and the small kitchen inside Madison's Ahan is buzzing. Water is boiling, chicken is roasting, and dumplings are frying. Before they even begin taking orders for the lunch rush, the chefs are preparing two big catering orders.
So today it's 3 Lao egg rolls, 3 vegetable egg rolls, and 3 orders of wontons, a couple orders of dumplings, a couple orders of summer rolls.
That's Jamie Huang, co-owner and executive chef of Ahan.
Well, the word Ahan actually just means food, and I just like wanted it to be something cute and playful, and Lao was my first language, so I just thought it'd be like cute to be like this, our happy, like that there was something new that they could look forward to or something comforting, you know?
Huang calls Ahan's food comfort food. And at the heart of it is her mother, Manola Huang.
Earliest food memories? Probably her making papaya salad, like a mortar and pestle in the mornings, making sticky rice, like the smell of sticky rice early in the mornings.
And I make papaya too. She said, Mom, I like to eat papaya too. I say,
That's Manola Huang, who grew up in Laos.
And I say, baby, I make a little bit spicy for you. And she like to eat. And I make noodle soup for Mom. I need two hot chili and lamb. And I put lamb and hot chili for Jimmy. Some people young, they don't like to eat hot.
She got her start early.
Uh-huh. And bak chokong Jimmy there.
Oh, yeah. I need one tofu, Mom.
Jamie Huang grew up in kitchens. Her family has owned restaurants across Wisconsin, in places like La Crosse, Beaver Dam, and Madison.
When I do the side job in the kitchen, peel the shrimp, she come to peel with me too.
My mom said I started becoming interested in peeling shrimp when I was like 3.
Eventually, Jamie went to culinary school. That led to jobs at some of Madison's hottest restaurants, where she received high-end training. Still, she credits her mom, Manola, for being her biggest culinary inspiration.
I think it wasn't always the path I was going to take, but I've been really happy because, you know, I've been able to, like, take some of her recipes, and I'll be able to pass them down, like her like khao soi recipes, like from her specific city in Laos called Luang Prabang. It's like a specific soup to her. And she said her grandma taught her mom, and her mom taught her. So right now I'm making a pram long song with chicken, a red curry udon with chicken, and then I'm also going to put a fried rice on it.
Jamie Huang's affection for her mother's recipes, her love of lime, chili, and cilantro, and her belief in using local seasonal produce is getting her recognized by her peers in the industry. She's a semi-finalist for a James Beard Award as Emerging Chef. The nomination had an immediate impact on her business.
I mean, obviously it's been really crazy busy. Like, it was busy before, but now it's just like next level busy. I think for staff, you know, it's really showed them, you know, all their hard work is really paying off, and I think it's like setting the standard and setting them to teach new staff that comes in and showing them to always be proud of their work, and you know, like anything's possible. Oh, you can take the rice from over here too. Everything that we've learned from my mom and everything is like, you know, really coming full circle, and like all the hours we put in and stuff, you know, it really just made it feel like super like rewarding, you know.
I happy for my daughter do a good job, you know.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for Marketplace comes from Offsite, an infrastructure and IT services company. Offsite provides managed cybersecurity services.
Classical music schedule, including weekend and overnight offerings, visit WPR.org.
Playing the Brooklyn Nets tonight. That tip-off is set for 6:30. In weather today, we'll see some fog clearing throughout the morning with high temperatures in the 30s and 40s. Chance for a wintry mix in eastern Wisconsin overnight into tomorrow. Good chance for some mixed precipitation throughout the day as well, with highs still in the 30s and 40s. I'm Alex Crow. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Asma Khalid. Americans are more divided than ever over how to tackle the escalating fentanyl crisis. The drug is killing an unprecedented number of people in the United States. I'm joined this morning by three reporters to talk about this crisis and what might come next. Brian Mann is NPR's addiction correspondent. Martha Biebinger is a health reporter with WBUR in Boston. And Aneri Patani is a senior correspondent with KFF Health News. Thank you all for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brian, let's start with you. The opioid epidemic has been raging for quite some time. Why is this moment so much deadlier?
2023 really was different. We're seeing more than 112,000 people dying every year in the United States. We used to think it was a catastrophe that 60 to 70,000 Americans were dying every year from drug overdoses. Now it's a lot worse. And the street supply of drugs keeps getting more toxic, not just with fentanyl, but also now we're seeing other deadly chemicals like methamphetamines and xylazine all mixed together in these drug cocktails. Louise Vincent is an activist helping people with addiction in North Carolina.
We've had an entire community swept away. I can't even think of all the people that I know that have died. I mean, so many people are dead. My daughter died. Our mentors are dead.
Hey, Asma, this is Aneri. I just wanted to chime in because I think what Louise just said there, what we heard from her, is really reflecting what we're seeing in the statistics, too. I mean, overdoses are now the leading cause of death for people in America ages 18 to 45. And they're also one of the leading things killing pregnant women and women who've just given birth. So this is just an incredibly devastating moment. And I think we're hearing that from people.
And Brian, I've got a follow-up question here. The overdose death rate has been incredibly high now for years. So why are we not seeing solutions?
You know, the Biden administration says they are attacking this problem with a lot more money and policy ideas. But the bottom line, and every drug policy expert I talk to agrees on this, the tools we've used in the past to fight drug epidemics just aren't working.
Brian, this is Martha. I'm going to jump in on that with another frustration.
And that's that even as the death rates are this high, we're seeing some mainstream medical providers who aren't really helping. There are medications and treatments for addiction. You might have heard of drugs like buprenorphine or methadone, but there's a lot of stigma and a lack of training, and so many doctors don't use them. They won't prescribe them to their patients, or they just don't take people in addiction as patients.
Martha, sticking with you, you know, given that the tools that we've been talking about for dealing with addiction have not worked, people are turning to a strategy that's been used for years in other countries called harm reduction. Can you explain to us what that is?
So harm reduction is about keeping people alive while they use drugs. And Asma, that might mean handing out naloxone and needles or pipes so that people don't share equipment and spread diseases. Some harm reductions will even monitor drug use to prevent a fatal overdose. But harm reduction is also an attitude shift, and this is a really important part. It's about treating people who use substances with respect and kindness, not shaming and blaming them. Here's one harm reduction worker, Renee, describing her work.
The stuff is just the carrot that I dangle before the horse. I'm wanting to make a connection with you.
So, Asma, that connection that Renee and others talk about is meant to help restore dignity and self-respect and be a path to recovery. Now, some of what Renee and others do to keep people alive, like supervising drug use, is illegal. So we're not using her full name and we have altered her voice.
Harm reduction is widely accepted in Canada, also in Europe. It is still controversial, though, here in the United States, and the backlash against it does appear to be growing in some corners. And why is that?
So, Asma, in short, it's seen as enabling drug use. Opponents see giving someone a needle or showing compassion. They see that as condoning drug use or condoning bad behavior. And they argue that the focus should be on sending, including Massachusetts, where I live. So there's a tug of war between the punishing or tough love approach and the softer, more compassionate model of harm reduction that's happening daily.
Aneri, I want to bring you into the conversation. You know, we have heard news that drug companies have agreed to pay more than $50 billion in compensation for their role in spurring the opioid crisis. Is that money helping? What is that money going towards?
So it really differs depending on which state you look at. And honestly, it's too soon to tell if it's helping across the country, but you're seeing a lot of the same issues play out that Martha and Brian were just talking about. So some states, even despite the urgency with people dying every day, some states haven't touched their settlement funds yet. Other places are looking at investing in naloxone or harm reduction techniques like Martha was talking about. And then you have places that are at the other end saying, we need to give this money to law enforcement. So they've bought patrol cars, roadside cameras, body scanners for their jails. The thing is, there's just not a lot of evidence that those sorts of investments will prevent overdoses or save lives. And a lot of families are upset. So Carrie Spears in Ohio is one of them. She lost her 23-year-old nephew, Tanner, to a fentanyl overdose 2 years ago. Her small town has spent most of its settlement cash on surveillance equipment and training for their officers and canines. And she's just not sure how that's going to save people like her nephew.
Not that I don't support law enforcement or first responders, but what research did they look at that said, yeah, surveillance equipment and canine helps people get into recovery and sobriety?
And what I'm hearing from my reporting is that just like in that town where Carrie lives, a lot of times decisions about the settlement money is not so much based on evidence, but on geography and politics of the place.
Speaking of politics, I've got a final question for you all here. How is fentanyl, the fentanyl crisis, likely to play out as an issue in the 2024 election?
Let me take that one, Asma. Public policy experts I talk to really worry that this is going to get ugly politically, with a lot of politicians really weaponizing the fentanyl issue. There's a lot of disinformation out there about this topic and ideas that research suggests don't actually help save lives. A lot of promises are being made, for example, to stop fentanyl smuggling into the U.S., but no one, Democrats or Republicans, have plans that anybody thinks would actually do that. Real solutions to this crisis are likely going to be a lot more complex, involving things like reforming healthcare and expanding access to housing and mental health care. And, you know, trying to do that kind of work in 2024 in America's polarized political culture, everyone I'm talking to says it's going to be really tough, especially if these deaths keep rising.
That is NPR's Brian Mann, along with WBUR's Martha
Heritage of Prairies, with keynote speaker Justin Thomas. Details at theprairieenthusiasts.org.
Support comes from UW Parkside's Adventures in Lifelong Learning, offering a group called Great Decisions. This group is part of America's largest discussion program on world affairs. For more information, visit uwp.edu/ALL.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.